Hello, full-bodied family. Thank you all so much for tuning into another episode of the Full-Bodied Crime Podcast. As always, my name's Kayla, and I'm your host for the morning or afternoon or evening or whatever time of day you're listening to this episode. I just appreciate you being here with us. And seriously, you guys, from the bottom of my little podcasting heart, I just want to say thank you so very much for your support. The podcast is doing very great, and I'm so proud of it and happy. It's like my little baby at this point. So every time I get a download, I get so excited. You guys have no idea. I'm like a kid in a candy store. So just thank you all so very much for your support. And I guess let's give you what you came here for. So without further ado, let's get into this crime. And just remember, it's not for children and listener discretion is advised. And on this episode of the podcast, I did want to do something a little different and do some research on a case that took place in a different part of the world versus being domesticated to the United States where I live, as I'm sure you have gathered by now because of my accent or my lack of accent. How does that work? Like, to me, I obviously don't have an accent, but to you guys, I do, right? I have a few New Zealand listeners, so thank you to you guys, but I'm sure I have an accent there, so. But anyway, I did want to do an episode in a different country, so this place is definitely on my bucket list to go to, and before we get into the episode, I did want to give a little bit of credit to Eleanor Neal. She provided a lot of information on the early life of this victim, and then early life on, I wanted to give credit to the Police Tapes documentary on this case, so. Without further ado, let's get into the episode right now. On this episode, we're going to be discussing the murder of Rebecca Marie Watts. Rebecca, also known as Becky, was born on June 3rd, 1998 in Bristol, England. Now, I did some research on Bristol, England, and you guys, it's seriously so beautiful. It's unlike any town I've ever seen, really. And per their annual Sunday Times guide, in 2017, Bristol was named the best place to live in the UK. And this was based off of factors which included school performance and crime rates. Yes, you heard that right, crime rates. And viewing pictures of this town, it seriously has luscious green scenery. And for all my United States friends, you know how in California there's like various shades of green, but in Washington there's completely different shades of like these vibrant and dark green colors? Well, the Bristol area was very, very Washington green. That's really the only way I know how to explain it. I'll post pictures of it on my Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter page so you guys know what I'm talking about. But in summary, Bristol is a super beautiful area with a population of around 500,000 and the crime rates are very, very low, which makes this story even more chilling and evil and eerie and sinister. I mean, Bristol's supposed to be super safe. So what happened to Rebecca Marie Watts? How was a young, gorgeous girl brutally murdered in this town that basically uses safety as its sales point? So Becky was born in Bristol to her mother Tanya Watts and father Darren Galsworthy. Now, I'm unsure why she didn't have her father's last name. I wasn't able to find too much information on that, but regardless, her biological parents were named Tanya and Darren, and from infancy, Becky's primary caregiver was her father. Her mother was reported to have some sort of financial and social services issues, so custody was awarded to her father early on, and that's who Becky lived with throughout the remainder of her life. Now, Darren Galsworthy, Becky's father, he remarried when Becky was just 2 years old, so at that age, Becky and her older brother Daniel Watts, who was 4 at the time, had a new stepmother named Angie. Being that the children were both so young, Angie Galsworthy was basically a strong mother figure in their lives, and both of the children had lived with their father and lived with Angie, so she was kind of like their primary mother in a sense. I don't want to put Tanya on the back burner, but Angie basically did raise them with their father, Darren. So in this new life with Darren, Daniel, and Becky, Angie also brought in a son named Nathan Matthews. Now, he was about 10 years older than Becky, so when she was 2, he was 12, and he was not too fond of having a step family. You know, I can somewhat relate to Nathan because back in the day, oh my gosh, I was the worst child of my poor mother. My parents divorced when I was 2, and whenever she would start dating someone, I was probably the closest thing to a demon child. Like, I did not want to share my mom at all at that age. My dad, I was somehow, like, nice to my dad and his girlfriends for some reason, but I made the dating game extremely hard for my mom. So, mom, if you're listening, older, more mature, less evil me, super apologizes, but then again, it led you to my stepdad now, who I absolutely adore. He is one of my favorite things on this entire planet, so I guess it all worked out in the end, but yeah, I can somewhat relate to Nathan because just when you're young, it's hard to accept a step family, especially when you're having to share your mom with not just a new father figure, but also 2 children. But Nathan found it difficult to get adjusted to this life, and he would constantly bully Becky. Since she was 10 years younger, it's easy to speculate that they really had nothing in common, but he would say mean things and call her ugly, say she's fat, and throughout her upbringing, he would constantly just be terrible to her. Now, luckily, Nathan was only usually around on weekends because he lived with his father, but the relationship between Becky and Nathan never really had any marked improvement as they both grew older. So as Becky grows older and into her preteen years, she's now not only being bullied by her stepbrother Nathan whenever he's home on weekends, but she's also now being bullied at school. Once again, people are calling her fat, ugly, and just being truly terrible and mean to Becky, which I honestly don't understand because I really couldn't find any pictures where Becky looked overweight. Not even in the slightest. I mean, she was overall like a stunning, beautiful girl. So these bullies must have just had hate in their hearts or had to have been jealous because seriously, at that age compared to Becky, I looked like a toe. So Becky was beautiful. So Becky's finding it extremely hard to deal with these bullies, and it's gotten to the point where she comes home crying every single day. And this begins to affect everything else in her life. Now she's shy, she doesn't want to go out, she's less social, eating less. I mean, she's taking everything these bullies are saying to absolute heart. And her family's seeing, you know, one warning sign after the other. So they're basically like, hey, you know, if you feel overweight, let's get you some healthy food. Let's develop a healthier lifestyle together. Whatever you need to make you feel good in your own skin, let's do it. And that's the hard thing about this whole teasing and bullying thing. I like to think if I was a parent, I would pull them out of school and accommodate them, you know, with talking to a counselor and trying to reassure them that they're not the problem. It's, you know, these little, well, assholes, for lack of a better word. I'm trying not to cuss at all on this podcast, but, like, you know, that's what they are. Bullies are big old booty holes, but the scariest thing in this world is that it's all getting worse, and social media is not contributing well to the situation. And, like, what the heck is up with this whole rate my picture thing? I see that with all these younger family members of mine. They'll, like, post and be like, oh, if you like this, I'll rate you. What is that? So it's unfortunately bullying's on an upward trend for sure versus a downward. And it's making me honestly scared to even have kids because just looking generationally, it's getting worse and worse and worse. And there's new bullying outlets brought to the world seemingly every few years. But Becky's family is aware that she's being bullied and they try to help her any way they can, but the bullying just continues to worsen. And at this point, Becky has lost so much weight that she's breached past being underweight and is clinically diagnosed with anorexia at just 12 years old. Even being underweight, even being anorexic, these bullies are still making her feel self-conscious and are basically tormenting her. And it doesn't help that when she gets home, which should be a place where everyone feels safe and comfortable in their skin, Becky still has to deal with her stepbrother Nathan calling her fat and continuously making comments about her appearance. And just to put it back into perspective, Nathan is a little over 10 years older than Becky, so when he's bullying her, he's in his early 20s. So this isn't just some kid who's saying all these stupid, degrading comments. It's a grown man, which had to hurt Becky even worse because we tend to associate age and authority. So it was very, very difficult for Becky to handle hearing all these terrible comments coming from not only her stepbrother, but a grown adult. So Becky is understandably in a low place. She's now very shy, timid, and doesn't really want to go outside into the real world at all. But luckily, after some time, her parents do get the help she needs, and Becky successfully overcomes her anorexia and begins gaining and maintaining a healthy weight. She is happier at this point, but she has now kept to herself so much throughout the years at school that she only has a very few and tight-knit close group of friends who she keeps in routine contact with versus a bunch of people. And they were a saving grace a lot of the time, and they were seemingly the only ones who kept in routine contact with Becky and were basically were her main form of social contact. I mean, she was active on social media in her teenage years because, you know, now we're in 2014, 2015, when Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, when those are all somewhat in their prime and everyone is obsessed with social media. So Becky was in that social media stage, but she only did have a few very close friends. Now, after battling the eating disorder and finally overcoming that obstacle, while also dealing with normal teenage hormone changes, overcoming bullying, and trying to improve her mental health, Becky and her family are hit with another huge, huge upset around the age of 15. So Angie Galsworthy, Becky's stepmom, began developing MS. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with MS or multiple sclerosis, it's an autoimmune disease that significantly affects the central nervous system, which consists of your brain and spinal cord. And what happens is basically your cells start eating away the lining that protects your nerves. In a normal person, your nerves receive some sort of signal or stimulus, and that sends the signal down this long, almost tail-looking thing called an axon, and you have these Schwann cells and myelin sheath that basically aid the impulse from getting where it needs to go. It's kind of like a frog on a lily pad, just kind of jumping from one side of the pond to the next. But when you have MS, you have damage to these lily pads, if in my little analogy here. So you have damage to the myelin sheath, though. So these lily pads, you know, the frog basically has nowhere to jump to. So it takes a while for your body to be able to generate nerve impulses. And, you know, you basically degrade in front of your family's eyes. And then on top of that, you also get scar tissue because our bodies naturally try to heal ourselves and our wounds. So you get scar tissue where this damaged myelin sheath is. So that's basically a huge another obstacle for this, you know, nerve impulse to get down to. So now the frog's not only on broken lily pads, he's having to jump over huge mud piles, and I don't know, hopefully you understand my analogy. The frog's trying to get from one end of the pond to the other, you know. But this was a huge, huge impact to the family, and, you know, it had to be so hard for Darren, seeing the woman that he loved dealing with such a hardship, but it was also so terrible for Nathan, Daniel, and Becky. So Becky continues surviving each day, taking each and every day as it comes, one by one, until February 19th, 2015, when something happens. TheGuardian.com basically summarizes the events of that day as it was Thursday, February 19th of 2015, and that day was like any other day for 16-year-old Becky. She was in her Crown Hill home in Bristol, and the night before, she had actually stayed the night at a friend's house, so everything was seemingly normal. And the day felt like it was going to be another routine Thursday in the life of Becky Watts. And from my understanding, she did secondary school, which is kind of like homeschooling. So she didn't have school this day. And as I mentioned, Becky's stepmother had MS. So that Thursday, she had an appointment regarding her MS. So Angie and Becky, I believe they exchanged a quick conversation before Angie went to her appointment at around 11:15. And Becky just went up to her room. At this point, Angie is gone, and Becky's in the house with her stepbrother Nathan and his girlfriend Shauna. So mind you, Nathan is still not a kind man to Becky, so they didn't even interact. She goes to her room, Nathan's in his room, and after some time, Nathan and his girlfriend hear the front door slam and assume Becky has left to go out and be with her friends or do something for the day. So Angie returns from her appointment and Becky isn't home. And the family at this point is thinking, well, you know, that's kind of strange. Becky's gone. She didn't tell anyone where she was going. Her laptop's gone. Her cell phone's gone. But her money, clothes, makeup, all that's here. So you would think if she was running away, she would need her, you know, makeup and money. But Additionally, all her room seems otherwise very undisturbed, and there's no signs of a struggle. There's no indication that something ominous happened. So their logistic mind is basically assuming that Becky went out to go study or went to go be with one of her friends. They really, at this point, didn't feel like anything was that abnormal. And truthfully, they were probably somewhat glad she wasn't home, because maybe that meant she was going out and engaging with her peers and having some social interactions like other normal 16-year-olds do. So they really think nothing of it at this time and assume Becky will be home within a few hours or by the next day. The next day comes and it's now February 20th, 2015, and Becky still hasn't come home. She's not answering or returning her parents' phone calls, and their brains are naturally like, wait a minute, something isn't feeling right here. And regardless of being a teenager, Becky is responsible, and she would have called by now, so something just isn't sitting right with Darren and Angie at this time. And their suspicions are even further confirmed when Becky's friends begin calling them and asking where Becky is. I'm sure the conversation went along the lines of, you know, she's not with you. No, I thought she was with you. Well, maybe she's at another friend's house, blah, blah, blah. But at this time, they cannot figure out where Becky is. And her friends are also reporting that her social media accounts have gone completely silent. And let's be real, guys. I remember being 16 and my phone was attached to my hip. I'd put my phone in the kitchen at 9 p.m. every night. And I was so dramatic. And I thought the world was literally crumbling at my feet whenever it hit 9 p.m. because that's when I, like, basically had to put my social media away, and it was barely in its infancy, and it is so ridiculous. But I couldn't imagine being 16 and just completely disengaging myself from social media. So with this information included, her family and friends are sure that something isn't right. At this point, Darren decides to call the police so that they can help with finding Becky. And, you know, the police tape documentary, the conversation pretty much just goes, my daughter's missing, we need your help, blah, blah, blah. So at this point, law enforcement suspects a teenage runaway and that Becky is bound to return at any moment, but she doesn't. And Friday the 20th goes by, then Saturday the 21st goes by, and nothing. Her family is in absolute agony now because they know Becky. They know that she wouldn't just run away. And she isn't hiding out at a friend's house because all of her friends are calling her wondering where she is. They know she's in danger and that something sinister and terrible has happened to her. So the following day, on Sunday the 22nd, 2015, the Avon and Somerset police begin to take action and they make their first appeal to the public. Now, this appeal is also posted throughout the world of social media with the hashtag FindBecky, and the appeal basically states, Rebecca, or this is actually a direct quote, so quote, Rebecca, known as Becky, is a 16-year-old that is missing from St. George, Bristol. Becky was last seen at her home in Crown Hill, St. George on the morning of Thursday, February 19th, and is thought to have left home at around 11:15 a.m. Becky is described as a white girl, age 16, about 5'4" and of slim build. She has long, red, auburn hair. We are keen to piece together where she went after leaving her home on Thursday. Any information, no matter how insignificant you think it is, might prove a crucial role in helping us find Rebecca. Now, we're at Monday, so Becky has been missing 4 days at this point, and her family has been waiting in absolute agony. The police finally release an appeal the day before, and it's now the family's time to reach out to the media, and her father is on camera just absolutely heartbroken, begging for the safe return of his daughter. He basically is pleading with Becky that if this is voluntary, please come home. She won't be in any trouble. Just please let us know you're safe. And basically his appeal to the public is ended when he emotionally can't speak anymore. I mean, it's so sad to watch, and he just becomes completely emotional and distraught on camera. And then to add on, Becky's grandmother, who was actually her mom's mother, I believe, she said, quote, Becky, we love you so much. We all love you and want you back home with us. You're so loved. I don't think you realize just how much. You can come home and stay at mine for as long as you need. If you are Becky's friend and you're sheltering her, you're not doing right by Becky. Just please get in touch. No, both of them are tearful on screen, and they're clearly in agonizing pain, just waiting and wondering where on this planet Becky is. So the next day, so now we're on to Tuesday the 24th, the police issue another statement basically reinstating what her family members had said. And to top it off, they're once again reassuring Becky, if you're out there listening, you are in no trouble. You won't be in trouble at all. Just please come home. Have whoever you're with contact us and let us know you're safe. We just need to know you're safe. But all their appeal efforts go completely unnoticed, and there's no word from Becky and no word from anyone who has her. And at this point, her parents and investigators are seemingly coming to the realization that this isn't just a runaway. This isn't the actions of a 16-year-old, and nonetheless, they're 16-year-old who left on their own. Something terrible has happened to Becky Watts. So later on in the week, there are a few new leads in the case, and one of the leads being that there has recently been a white van circling in the area near Becky's home. So investigators are intrigued by this piece of information, and I mean, most of the time, a white van seen lurking in her neighborhood is never good news. So investigators begin looking into this lead, but around the same time, one of Becky's best friends also informs investigators that she has recently been dating a 17-year-old, which was completely new news to the family because Becky was shy. She didn't really enjoy socializing, so they're kind of thrown off by the mention of a boyfriend, but their relationship was fairly new. They had only been together a few months, and he was able to provide additional information, basically saying that he had texted Becky that day she went missing on the 19th, and he never received a reply. So maybe he did help establish a little bit of a timeline, and his alibi did seem to check out. So as both of these leads were being investigated, it is now 1 week exactly since Becky was last seen. And in just a few short days, the hashtag FindBecky and the world of social media was absolutely flooded with Becky's story. It was reaching over 2 million people at this point, and investigators were sure they would have some information on the whereabouts of Becky Watts in no time. So during this time, police are also searching the woods near Becky's home, and there are numerous people, including law enforcement, family, friends, volunteers, search dogs, but once again, their efforts were unsuccessful, and they were unable to find any evidence or clues leading to the whereabouts of Becky Watts throughout the search of the woods near her home. And I just want to note that in unison with the ground searches, Becky's dad, stepmom, and anyone else living in the house are asked to leave for an extended period of time so that detectives can properly process the scene, because that was the last place Becky was seen alive. So the family is asked to leave their house on the 25th. Now, mind you, Becky has been missing since the 19th, so in my opinion, this kind of seems like a very long time for investigators to have waited to process the scene that Becky was last seen out alive, but, you know, I wasn't there. They could possibly have a good reason for it. I just think the time delay is a bit odd because if something did occur in her room, that's sure a lot of time to cover up any potential evidence. So the house is being processed for numerous days, but on Saturday, February 28th, 2015, there's a huge break in the case. Becky's father gets a call that two people have been arrested on suspicion of the murder of Becky Watts. And her father's basically like, wait, what? Murder? I thought we were just looking for my missing, kidnapped, or disappeared daughter who's alive. But obviously murder was inevitably in the back of their heads. But I mean, they really didn't believe at this time that they would be hearing those words. So the family was absolutely devastated. And honestly, the reason why these two individuals were arrested for murder is quite vague. And it's not really discussed on either of the documentaries or reports about this case. So I hate reporting the information that I don't really have a lot of supporting evidence for, but it was critical to the case that, you know, two people were arrested because it did take, you know, somewhat of a focus of attention onto these two people versus anybody else that could have been involved in the crime. But Basically, an arrest is made on the 28th, and the arrest is of two individuals of completely unknown genders, so we have no idea if this was two males, a male and a female, two females. It's very unclear who these two were and how they were involved in the case, but their house, garden, and vehicle searched, and a few days after the arrest, they are free to go. And I feel like the information on these two is so vague, obviously to protect their identities, which I totally understand. I'm just curious as to how they even landed on these people in the first place and how the case, you know, escalated from a missing person to suspicion of murder. So, these two individuals are released from custody, and police are still processing the scene of Becky's home. Investigators are sure that there's something in the house that's going to lead them to where Becky is. So, they go up to her room, and that's when they notice something that they had previously overlooked. Something that was plain as day in front of their face, but not immediately noted by the human eyes in a quick passing glance. In the molding around her doorframe, they spot what appears to be human blood. Now that they see this new potential clue, they also note some abnormalities with how the blood is settled around the doorframe. There's some blood near the bottom, some near the middle of the doorframe, and some at the top of the doorframe. So, to them, this indicates a struggle, and at this point, investigators now know that something terrible has happened to Rebecca Watts, and it appears that they're standing in the center of her crime scene. But blood evidence is not the only thing that they find. Lying in the blood evidence is a bloodied imprint. All of this evidence, from the blood sample to the bloody imprint, which is a fingerprint, is sent off to the lab for testing, and investigators are eagerly waiting for the phone call from the lab that will bring them some answers to their questions. Whose fingerprint is that? Is it human blood on the wall? Well, whose blood is it? Is it Becky's blood? Is it an intruder's blood? Is this the blood of someone who killed her? Like, investigators are waiting in agony for these results so that all their questions are answered. But while the results are pending, they continue to search and search the surrounding areas for any signs of Becky, but their efforts once again result in no significant findings. But the moment has finally come where investigators get the call regarding whose fingerprint was left in blood on the frame of Becky's door. And the fingerprint belongs to none other than Becky's stepbrother, 28-year-old Nathan Matthews. Now, investigators are surprised over this, but I wouldn't say they're shocked, because investigators have already interviewed Nathan and Shauna, and Nathan was 28 at the time, Shauna was 21, so they had been interviewed on numerous occasions, and truly the two were throwing red flag after red flag to investigators. Both seemed completely uninterested in the whereabouts of Becky. Shauna was literally giggling during her interview, and they were both basically trying to joke and laugh with the detective, seemingly being totally blind to the fact that Becky was missing and in danger. Additionally, their stories were extremely consistent and accurate, and as you all probably know, this is a huge sign indicating that their alibis were rehearsed. And one thing I learned in my forensic psychology class is that if you're trying to figure out if someone's lying, you should always ask for the story backwards. People continually rehearse the story from beginning to end, and it's a huge wrench thrown in their plan if you ask them to tell you the events backwards, because if it's the truth, you can remember what you did that day backwards, but if they're telling a lie, it's exactly how they rehearsed, and they don't know it any other way, so they knew that something was definitely abnormal with Nathan and Shauna, and Nathan had nothing nice to say about Becky, and you know, he never went into her room naturally, so it made no sense as to why his fingerprint was even on the side of her door, unless he was over there when she was being abducted or murdered. Now, here's a small clip of Nathan during the investigation, just so you know how calm and detached and seemingly unconcerned he really was.
So how would you describe your relationship with Becky?
I didn't particularly talk to her, but obviously I don't particularly like her. And obviously what annoys me is the way she speaks to, like, my mum sometimes. Mm-hmm. She'd be kind of, like, rude or whatever. I'm trying to think of an actual specific time.
So with how cold Nathan was and with the fingerprint results, investigators are now putting all the pieces of the puzzle together. evil older stepbrother who continuously bullies his little sister, Becky. He doesn't like how she treats his mother. The anger is just continually building up year by year until he snaps. Detectives are literally just waiting for the blood evidence to come back so that they can make an arrest on not just Nathan, but Shauna as well. Because at this point, they have both said on numerous occasions that they were both in the home at the time that Becky disappeared. So if Nathan was involved at that time of the day, Shauna must have been involved too. Investigators then get the second call that they've been waiting for. The blood at the scene on Becky's doorframe, the blood that was the means of molding and preserving Nathan's fingerprint, was positively identified as the blood of Rebecca Marie Watts. Now, investigators immediately go to arrest Nathan and Shauna and begin their extensive questioning to get an answer to their burning question. Where is Rebecca? They begin their questioning with Shauna, and she sticks to the same story. I was washing my hands in the kitchen, heard the front door slam, I never even saw Becky. I just presumed that that was her, the one who left and slammed the door. Now, Shauna is clearly manipulative and lying, and her body language during the interview is somewhat reserved, but she has her arms crossed and is slumped over, but the way she's answering questions was just so odd to me. Here's another clip. You're going to have to listen closely because the audio is very faint, but just listen to how eerie this is.
Is there anything that happened that could be significant in the disappearance of Rebecca? No. Are you absolutely sure? Yes. I know you've got something to tell us. Mm. I can see it in your face.
I was just making sure there was nothing, like, a weird, significant thing that I hadn't thought of.
Her pauses were so unnatural, and while watching this video, I seriously feel like she's playing a video in her head of Becky's murder. Like, she's looking in the corner of the room and not looking at the investigator, and she's just staring off into space and then answering the questions that after a pretty extended period of time. So, and then it looks like she snaps back into reality of the situation and realizes she's being investigated for a murder. So when investigators begin interviewing Nathan, they know that they have to make, like, a different approach with him. Nathan's not only manipulative, but he's also very controlling. So they know that in order to get anything out of him, they have to present the situation in a different manner of letting him feel like he's in control. So that's exactly what they do. They make him feel comfortable. They give him the spotlight and allow him to talk to investigators on what he believes are his terms. But in a snap, investigators throw Nathan a curveball and regain control over the questioning and basically begin to challenge Nathan, which completely throws him off guard. They begin asking him direct questions of his involvement in the disappearance of Becky, and he's just short and cold and basically denies having any involvement in the case. Although seriously, I feel like you can clearly see that he is hiding something by his interview. So while the two are in custody and being questioned, forensic investigators go to Nathan and Shauna's house to see if they can find Becky, hopefully alive, or if they can find any clues leading to where she is. Now, police are immediately taken back because Shauna and Nathan's house was very, very, very cluttered, and there was stuff literally everywhere. It was completely unorganized, and it just appears somewhat hoarderish, honestly, and there's mounds of trash everywhere. The dishes are all piled up. There's items all over the stoves and countertops. Random items literally thrown everywhere, stacking one on the other. They definitely needed to have to watch that, like, Marie Kondo Netflix show where you, like, rearrange your life, because their house was just plain nasty. And that's really the only way to describe it, was absolutely filthy and disgusting. But how filthy this house was is basically what leads investigators to the next big clue. Amidst their bathroom having clutter everywhere, and I mean clutter even consisting of a microwave, just completely disorderly, it's disgusting, just a nasty scene of a bathroom, but there was the bathtub. And the bathtub was absolutely spotless. It was recently bleached and sparkling. And also for you guys, I'll post a video of this bathroom on the Instagram page. FB_crime podcast. So this was a huge red flag to the investigators because these people didn't seem to care about cleanliness at all. And in front of them was a freshly washed and bleached bathtub. That makes no sense. So investigators now had additional confirmation that they weren't looking for a missing Rebecca Watts, but a murdered Rebecca Watts. So during their search of Nathan and Shauna's house, investigators also find a receipt dated for February 20th, 2015. So the day that Becky was reported missing. So she had been missing for one day at this point. And this receipt is for gloves, a face mask, goggles, and a circular saw. Surveillance footage from the hardware store confirmed that it is Nathan who picks up these items. So now investigators basically have a multitude of supporting evidence pointing to Nathan as a mastermind behind the murder of Becky. At this point, investigators have to tell Becky's father, Darren, and her stepmom, Angie, that everything is pointing to Nathan, that he's the one who killed and brutally killed their beloved daughter. Both of her parents were in absolute shock and disbelief. They now basically have confirmation that Rebecca is never coming home, and they are just completely devastated. Becky's dad, Darren, basically says that he just started screaming when they told him and shouting, "No, no, no." Now, working in an ER, unfortunately, some people do pass away in the setting, obviously, whether it be trauma or some sort of accident or heart problems, but there's nothing like the moment a parent loses a child. I mean, seriously, there's nothing like that. It's a howl. That's the only way I can explain it, and it's a howl that you can't unhear. And oh, there's just nothing worse than a parent losing the child. So I truly can't imagine what Darren and Angie were feeling knowing that Nathan, their other child, was responsible for the death and disappearance of their beloved daughter. At this point, investigators still have Nathan and Shauna in custody. And they present both of them with the knowledge that their home was basically forensically searched. And Nathan does ask for a lawyer immediately, but luckily, Nathan's lawyer approves a statement written by Nathan, and it is a confession that reads, quote, "I, Nathan Charles Matthews, accept that I am responsible for the death of Rebecca Watts. On the 19th February 2015, I attended Crown Hill, St. George, Bristol, with my girlfriend, Shauna Orr. In my car, I had a large bag, a sun device, handcuffs, tape, and a mask. I had developed an idea to scare Rebecca by kidnapping her. I wanted to scare her and teach her a lesson. I believe that she was selfish and her behavior towards my mother was a risk to her health. A few minutes after arriving, Shauna said she wanted a cigarette and went to the garden. I went to the boot of my car, took out the bag that contained the items, then went upstairs to the landing before knocking on Rebecca's door. She replied with a what or hello, and I said, 'Can I see you a minute?' I could not be sure what other things happened, but I used the items I had to subdue Rebecca. During this short struggle, my mask slipped and Rebecca was able to see my face. This caused me to panic, and I strangled her while she was partially in the bag." End quote. Now, even though this is the end of his written statement, Nathan goes on to confess that he then dismembered Beck's body in the bathtub with his circular saw. He then put her body parts in various bags, and it looks more like backpacks and luggage cases versus like garbage bags. But he placed the body parts in various bags and put the detached parts of Rebecca Watts in his storage shed outside of his home. Shauna ends up denying any knowledge of this attack on Becky, and she denies all involvement in the case. Additionally, Nathan is saying he acted alone, but they're both so calculated, and seriously, the only time I saw either of them show any emotion was after Nathan was caught. Nathan breaks down during an interview, but I truly don't think it had anything to do with remorse or sorrow for murdering Beck. This seems more like he is solely only upset because he's going to go to prison for quite a long time. So like I said, Shauna's denying all involvement and Nathan is saying he acted alone, but investigators aren't stopping until they can find something incriminating because they know Shauna and Nathan both had involvement in the case, and that's when they find the compelling evidence showing the horrific motivation behind the case. On Shauna's phone, her and Nathan had been Googling pornography related to teenage girls around Becky's age. Additionally, there had been text messages exchanged between the couple about kidnapping teenage girls, raping them, and killing them. Also, there was, I forgot on which website it was, but there was even a text message exchange where Shauna saw a girl at a fast food restaurant or something and was like, oh, I wanted to go up and knock her unconscious so that I could bring her home for us. It's just sick and sadistic things like that that they were exchanging back and forth. So at this point, investigators realize that Beck's murder is due to completely sadistic, sexually induced motive. And it's truly lucky that they caught these two before they could harm any other young girls, because they were on their way to doing some serious harm to this community. But the strongest evidence against Shauna came when they found her DNA on a face mask and additional DNA on one of the bags that stored the remains of Becca's body. So at this point, they have enough evidence to charge Shauna with involvement in the handling of Becky's body, and investigators are slowly but surely becoming more and more relieved as the evidence is incriminating the horrific couple is coming out little by little. Now, truthfully, I don't think their sentences are long enough, but Nathan was found guilty of murder and sentenced to life in prison with a minimum of 33 years, and Shauna was found guilty of manslaughter and sentenced to 17 years. I truly don't understand this sentencing. This couple was literally driving around, seeing girls that fit their sadistic standards, and were talking about bringing them back to their homes and killing them. They're extremely dangerous individuals, but I mean, I get that people can change, but seriously, they're heartless. Like, they showed no remorse. They both seem to have no care that they robbed a 16-year-old of her life. It's just insane to me that these two will eventually be let out and be back on the streets. I mean, 17 years, 33, that's not that long. Now, before I end this episode, if we revert back to Becky's younger years when she was undergoing therapy and counseling, she did mention on numerous occasions that Nathan was bullying her, and the facility that she received therapy at basically states that she was passed along through numerous different mental health care providers, and so none of them really had the time or opportunity to place Nathan as a potential threat to Becky. But a direct quote from the Bristol Safeguard Children Board states that her parents, Darren and Angie, had stated, quote, they wish they had realized the bullying she was experiencing from him at the time so they could have intervened to keep her safe, end quote. Becky's father said he was not given the parenting support he needed, so he relied on strategies such as telling Becky she would have to leave home if she did not behave. The report adds, he said how he understood that Becky's behavior was partially the result of what she'd been experiencing from her stepbrother. Like, it's crazy. Honestly, you guys, this is why I want to get into the mental health field. It's just a completely messed up system. I mean, to think that Beck's death could have been prevented had she had one therapist or one psychiatrist dedicated to her and listening to all her problems versus being like, oh, you're just going to see whoever's available. It frustrates me, but now, Beck's dad is continually mourning over his daughter, and he shares with the Police Tapes documentary that he often has dreams about Becky, where he can see her being murdered, but he sees Nathan and Shauna both conducting the murder, and who knows? Sometimes her dreams are there to give us answers, but truly, who knows what exactly happened to Rebecca Marie Watts on that fateful February 19th day. We don't know if her life was taken by the hands of one or two individuals. And unfortunately, justice does not seem like it was served in this case for how severe the crime was, but at least the streets are safe for a little bit of time, as the two are currently in prison and serving their sentences. But I don't think justice was served, honestly. I don't think that they should ever be let out, because they seem like, honestly, serial killers. Like the Barbie and Ken murderers, that's kind of exactly what they sound like, just the British version, so. Anyway, my friends, that is the murder of Rebecca Marie Watts. I apologize, I'm a little sick and under the weather, so my brain's a little foggy and my voice sounds a little groggy, but I just really wanted to get this episode out, and I'm excited for the next episode. A private investigator actually reached out to me, so I'll be doing the case that he took on, so I will have that to you guys shortly. I'm going to try to research it tomorrow, at work, but I work a double, so I'll get it to you as soon as I can. And as some of you may have noticed, the Instagram name did change from FB underscore crime to FB underscore crime podcast. It's just getting out there more. It's more searchable for people finding it that way, but people looking at it on the first few episodes will be able to find it regardless. So I hope that doesn't bring out about too much confusion. So, but please go give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcast at. And don't forget to check out our Twitter at Full Body Crime. Go subscribe to our YouTube channel, Full Dash Body Crime, and go like our Facebook, Full Dash Body Crime as well. And please go check out our website, full-bodycrime.com. There you can see our Gmail account for any cases that you would like me to cover. Also, it has some pictures about the case and some information on prior cases and where we get all the sources for our cases. So I think that's it, my friends. I need to go take a throat lozenge and probably go to bed because I have work in like 6 hours. So I adore you all, and I hope you guys have a beautiful and blessed day. Bye-bye.